Welcome to the Perspectives on Healthcare podcast, where members of the medical community from different roles, venues, and locations share their unique perspectives on quality healthcare, its future, and how to improve it. Now, from the Your Keynote Speaker studio in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, here is your host, Rob Oliver.
Thank you, and welcome to another edition of Perspectives on Healthcare. My guest today is Gurpreet Patta. He is a physician located out in Missouri. He has specialized in pain, addiction, obesity, and diabetes. He is a member of the baby boomer generation. Gurpreet, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. So tell me a little bit about yourself and your role in healthcare, please.
So I have an outsider's origin story. I was born outside the U.S. I came to the U.S. when I was very young, and I went to the inner city schools. I was the only brown kid with a turban in an all-black school, and eventually went to high school in an all-white school, being the only brown kid with a turban. So I was never on the inside. I was always on the outside examining the situation. I also had I had come from a country that was very socialist and was enamored by the capitalism that was here in the U.S. And so I was fascinated with how business worked and the ability to have practically anything you wanted if you were willing to work for it and if you had the business acumen. So I got the business bug early. I also had a background in computers, so I loved computer hacking, which got me in trouble. And so that's why I ended up in medical school, because I couldn't go into computers and I loved science. So I did medicine, and then eventually I took my computer hacking skills and started doing biohacking, understanding how physiology works. And so I started my world in trauma surgery, ended up going into anesthesia, converting from anesthesia to pain, because I was just enamored with how chemistry is and physiology, and expanded from there doing addiction, and then realized that there were common threads with inflammation, and went into the process of discovering how to reverse patients' diabetes, and realized that there was a common thread that was holding all this together, and all of these pandemics and all of these epidemics that we were facing had common thread. We have a pain epidemic, we have a addiction epidemic, we have a obesity epidemic, we have a diabetes epidemic, and recently we had a COVID pandemic. And I tell you that all of these are really pandemic, because they're all over the world. They're not just here in the United States. And the common thread is metabolic inflammation.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, if you don't mind?
Yeah. So what triggers all of this stuff together is that we have a defective metabolism. We have a mismatch in our biology between our genetics and our contemporaneous lifestyle. So until 12 to 15,000 years ago, we were hunter-gatherers. Only 12 to 15,000 years ago did we go into farming. And we didn't get industrialized seed oils until the mid-1920s to 1930s, and they didn't really take off till the late 1970s. So we're being hit with chemical compounds, especially industrial seed oil, and extremely refined carbohydrates that our bodies are not used to. We also have an issue that genetically we're hardwired for periods of extreme famine. So every time our body sees a nutritional object, it wants to hold on to that nutrition because we don't think we're going to be eating again for a while. And unfortunately, we have a mismatch because we have so much available nutrition that we tend to overeat, and we tend not to ever deplete our livers of glycogen. And so we tend to constantly eat, and we store that as fat. I'll give you an example. So the origin of food stamps, the origin of supplemental nutrition occurred because in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, the U.S. was afraid that it didn't have enough able-bodied individuals to join the armed forces. And there was a theory that if we were attacked, we wouldn't have enough people because they were rejecting half of the people that were applying for the armed forces because they were sarcopenically wasted. They didn't have the muscle mass and they were too thin. And now in the 2018 and beyond, 2017, 2016, 2022, you know, now, they reject half the people because they're morbidly obese and they're metabolically deficient. And they can't join because they can't do pull-ups. They can't even run around the block. So we've gone from a malnutrition of not enough to a malnutrition of excess. And it's a biological mismatch between our genetics, which are hardwired to hold on to nutrition, to when we have too much nutrition, the body doesn't know what to do with it. So it's a different perspective than sure. what most people look at.
But thanks for sharing that. What does quality healthcare mean to you?
So to me, quality healthcare is as much about understanding our role in society as guides for our patients. We really should be more Sherpa-like. We should first of all uphold a high standard for ourselves. If you have a fat doctor, he's not going to tell his fat patient that you should lose weight. So we have to become the role models, and we should have physicians that are biologically fit specimens that say, hey, you know, this is, and I know that seems strange, but, you know, it's your patients will not listen to you if they come into their doctor and the doctor is huffing and puffing and weighs 400 pounds or 350 and they're telling them lose weight. The chances that and physicians won't tell their patients. These are well-done studies already that document this. So one, we should be good role models. Two, we need to be able to step aside and stand aside from the overwhelming pieces of information that are forced upon us by the pharmaceutical industries that predominantly push an agenda of giving patients prescriptions that are incredibly expensive sometimes and perhaps maybe not even necessary. And so, you know, there's a tendency to medicalize every disease into a process that a pharmaceutical industry can make money on. The origin of medical schools, one of the early origins of medical schools, was that the pharmaceutical industry needed sales reps. And so that they helped push that into the medical schools. And so we need to be, as physicians, ask ourselves, you know, when we look at these studies, are they accurate? And is the information that I'm going to convey from the study, is it correct? I have a strict policy and have had this for 20 plus years. I won't let a sales rep into my clinic. I won't let them give us a lunch. I won't let, because even a donut might sway our decisions. Even a clicky pen might sway our decisions. So I don't think that you should allow that to occur. I don't think that we should allow any of that. I think that there's a role for appropriate teaching, but I don't think that we should allow gifts of any kind. Because I think that even they might be subtle or small, I think they change people's behavior. And so it's just a different approach.
No, understood. And there is an interesting side of it in which not only are the pharmaceutical companies marketing to the doctors, they're marketing directly to patients with the advertisements that say, ask your doctor if this is the right prescription, prescription for you.
So that's called pull marketing.
Yeah. Okay. You actually already answered my next question when I was going to ask you, can you give me an example of quality healthcare? And maybe do you have another example that you could provide? What does quality healthcare look like?
So for me, I practice in the urban core. I practice with patients that a lot of them don't have two nickels to rub together. And so I'm trying to help patients with very complex problems and come down to the root causes of their dysfunction. And help educate them so that they educate their community. So if we change dietary intake in the United States, that would eliminate 2/3 of most of our chronic diseases. Most type 2 diabetes, if the patient still produces C-peptide, can be reversed in a few weeks and get them off their insulin. you know, this continuous desire that we have to increase medications and never deprescribe is something that, I think is a major fault in our healthcare system. I think we should spend as much time asking ourselves, does the patient really need this? Is there a way that I can get them off of this? Is there a simpler approach? It may take a little bit more physician time, but if you can do that, you can make a bigger impact. And once you do that, then we can educate the patient, who can then educate their family. And I always look at patients not in the isolation of the silo that I'm seeing them in the room. I look at them and ask myself, you know, this patient's going to go home, and this patient's massively overweight. They're pre-diabetic or diabetic. Their kids are going to be probably massively overweight. Their spouse is going to be massively overweight. They're getting all of these signals. And so maybe what we need to do is have a more global approach and convince the whole family that we have to pull together. Because if I change this patient, but I don't fix the patient's husband or change the paradigm with which they're looking at this, then they're going to go right back to where they were because the culture is pulling them in a different direction. And sometimes patients don't like that. Sometimes families don't like that. But you really have to hold the line and say, look, you know, you may disagree with me, but let's give it a shot. Let's try. And so it's a more global approach.
Sure. What do you wish people understood about your role in healthcare?
I think there's a couple things, but the critical element, my particular role, would be that sometimes when we're trying to make changes in society, things don't always seem directly related. And so a lot of times patients will go, well, me eating less carbohydrates, what is that going to do for my pain? Or how is that going to reverse my diabetes? Or how does this affect my addiction? And so you have to continuously educate yourself, but then you have to be able to educate the patient. And I think that what's misunderstood often is that all of these things are interconnected. For example, patients do hedonic substitution. So hedonic substitution is the concept that I'll take pain medicine because I need it for my pain, but when I don't have access to my pain medicine, I might substitute fentanyl, or I might substitute sugar, or I might substitute gambling. And so there's this continuous this balancing act of trying to help patients in very complex situations return themselves to health and recognize that if you push here, it may cause a distortion in the field in a different place. So you have to take a global approach. And sometimes that can be hard to explain to other physicians because they go, well, why do you care? You know, what does metabolic inflammation have to do with the patient's blah, blah, blah? And they don't see the commonality of thread because they're not used to looking at it from a system standpoint. The human body is a complex adaptive system. And there are probably at least 7,000 to 10,000 pathways that affect obesity. There's a few thousand pathways that affect addiction. And there's, you know, a similar number that affect pain. And these are all interrelated. And so you have to be able to kind of map them out for patients and come up with some solutions.
Got it. What excites you about the future of healthcare?
I think how healthcare will change. I mean, certainly precision medicine is going to be valuable, and certainly some of our emerging technologies to live longer are going to be important. But I think eventually there will be a recognition that we made some mistakes in the past in healthcare, especially when we got away from saturated fats. I think eventually we'll come back to realize that cholesterol was not a bad thing. The cholesterol is probably healthy for us. We have a new cabal going on, though. We have the cholesterol cabal, which is pushing statins, but we have a new cabal that's going to start pushing very expensive medications on Alzheimer's patients. And that those medications really didn't work very well, and they're very expensive. So it's going to drive Medicare costs up. But my hope is that people will push back against that and recognize that Alzheimer's is a energy partition problem, and the tau protein is a resultant issue of insulin degrading enzyme going over time, and it's really type 3 diabetes of the brain. So there are some things that will have massive impact. My feeling is that eventually we'll get to the point where we can solve the complex problems with precision medicine, but we can solve everybody's problems with improvement in metabolic health. Right now, only 13% of the U.S. is metabolically healthy. That's terrible. I mean, 87% of people are metabolically deficient. This is a bad problem. We got to fix the biggest problem first.
That's a startling statistic. Last question for you. What is one thing medical professionals can start doing today to improve the quality of healthcare?
I think the one thing is engaging the patient and recognize that, especially patients look at us as coaches. They look at us as these role models. So I think that we should become the role models that they expect of us. We should walk the walk. We should talk the talk. We shouldn't say one thing and do something else. So if we're telling patients, you know, we don't really want you to have sugar-sweetened beverages. We don't want you to have artificial sugars. We don't want you to have vegetable oils. We want you to move. We as physicians should be doing the same thing. So we should probably get rid of the donuts and the bagels and all of those other things that we ourselves are consuming and make those changes in ourselves and be able to hold that out. I think that we have to do some staring at our own belly buttons. If our protocols are specifically saying we should have lifestyle change before we start pharmaceuticals, then why is it that patients go to their doctor and the doctor never mentions the lifestyle change but puts them on a statin and puts them on insulin or metformin? I mean, if lifestyle change comes first, then why not try that? I recognize that people come in with high hemoglobin A1Cs, and I recognize they may come in with high cholesterol, but, you know, it may be that their LDL-C is high, but their LDL-P is low. And if you don't measure those other markers, you may be going down the wrong path. And there may be simpler changes. It may be, you know, get rid of your sugars first, and that might drop your LDL-P, which is more valuable for you to drop. It may be other factors. So we should really not just give lip service to lifestyle changes. We should actually map that out for our patients.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I'm hearing you say is lifestyle change. I think I'm summarizing this: lifestyle change before pharmaceutical intervention. And yet, I think we live in a society where we're looking for easy and quick change as opposed to more sustainable and long-term change. And we're looking for immediate gratification. And I mean, basically the easy way out: give me a pill, I take the pill, it solves some of my issue. But what you're saying, I think, is that you've got to deal with the underlying issue. You've got to deal with the root cause. And when you handle that, it's going to be something that creates a long-term and sustainable change. Have I properly summarized?
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes you do have to put the bandage on there. But at the same time, you make the lifestyle change too. And so if somebody comes in and they have horrendous pain, they may need pain medicine. They may need injection. They may need therapy. But long term, they may need something else. They may need their metabolic inflammation reduced. If it's low back pain, they may need core strengthening of their iliopsoas muscles and their paraspinals. They may need gait change. There's a whole host of things that they may need. And so, your patient demands an immediate fix, but you have to keep the perspective of the long-term change so that they don't recycle, that you can get them better long-term. Exactly. I mean, you can't be so short-sighted just saying, oh, well, I'm just going to give you these meds, and then never go back and say, well, have you changed your diet? Did you get off of those, you know, 4 sodas a day? Did you stop eating corn chips in the middle of the night with ice cream? Did you improve your sleep pattern? And give them the appropriate coaching tips. And the first therapy, you know, if you have somebody coming in with horrendous anxiety, you may be giving them a benzodiazepine because you got to get them out of the woods today. But it may be an issue of gut microbiome. It may be your enteric nervous system is off and your vagus nerve is firing abnormally. And so you may have to look at their gut health to improve their anxiety. Same thing with depression. Keep a bigger spectrum and then don't just use the medication. Look at the other factors. So there's an emergent change that you have to do, but then you have to make sure that you've fixed it long term.
Got it. Hey, listen, thank you so much for being here. Gurpreet Bhatta, I appreciate you sharing your perspective on healthcare.
Thanks for listening to Perspectives on Healthcare. Visit perspectivesonhealthcare.com to learn more about Rob Oliver or to subscribe so you never miss an episode. If this podcast was valuable, we'd appreciate a review on iTunes. Or if you tell a friend or coworker about the show, that would be helpful too. Join us again next time for more Perspectives on Healthcare.